Well, good morning. I was a little humbled over the last couple of weeks listening to Tony's made a build-up for this one session, and as he's done his the two between the Testaments 1 and 2, this is between the Testaments number 3, and we want to look a little bit at the history that went on between really 430 BC and between 430 and 4 BC. I've done a couple of things. By the way, really, the amount of material, this is really interesting to me, and it's the amount of material here really need probably about 6 to 8 weeks to cover it well. And so we're going to do it in about 40 minutes, and I've disciplined myself in two different ways. Number one, it's on one piece of paper, and my notes are the same as your notes, okay? So I've got a lot more notes here, but I'm going to try not to open them because we'll spend too much time. The second thing is I really want to do, the reason I'm disciplining myself to do that, to talk more off the cuff and with very few notes, is because I want to hit the high points. I want to hit the broad swaths and the currents that we need to understand to help us conclude the Old Testament and set the tone or set the stage for the New Testament. So we're going to be very general, and again, my way of disciplining myself is having very few notes. And so I may forget some of the names and the dates, but I think I've got most of the important things on the notes. I want to talk just a few minutes about the importance of history to a Christian, the importance of history to a Christian. And I want to look at two passages just really quickly, both of them familiar passages. The first one in the book of Daniel, Now, for some of you, we've been talking about history for about, I think, 25 or 26 messages through the book of Daniel was steeped in history. For Tony to preach that, he had to give you a lot of historical context. And in fact, some of the narratives toward the end, some of the prophetic passages, were very historical. So the things we're going to talk about today are really, you've already gotten a good introduction to the history, the events that surround the ending of the Old Covenant, of the Old Testament writings and the beginnings of the New. But in the book of Daniel, I just want to remind you, and really Tony hit it hard in messages early on, but in Daniel chapter 4, there's a phrase that's repeated at least 3 times. And I remember underlining it as Tony preached it. It's in verse 17 of chapter 4. It's the end of that verse, where it says, "The periods of time, the sentences by the decree," and remember, this is Nebuchadnezzar talking about his dream and Daniel explaining the dream. It's all within that context. And he says, "Let the mind be changed from a man's, let the beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. The sentences by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that what?" His dream was so that the living would know what? "That the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom He will." Look over at across the page at the end of verse 25. In Daniel's interpretation, he says, "This thing will happen to you. You will go through this trial till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom He will." Then notice again at the end of verse 32, "until you know." And that was the emphasis on the humiliation of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had to get to the point where he realized that his kingdom was given to him and that his kingdom was ruled by him and that there was a much greater end than his own glory. And then if you look at verse 34, and down in that poetic script, when he praises God, he says, "For His dominion is everlasting dominion, and His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and He does according to His will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay His hand or say to Him, 'What have you done?'" So Daniel is asserting from the Most High that the Most High rules the kingdom of men. What does that mean? What does that mean? What does it mean that the Most High, and I'm just asking you to summarize some of the things you've heard in the lessons on Daniel. What does it mean that the Most High rules the kingdom of men? So what's the opposite? If the Most High doesn't rule the kingdom of men, then who does? Men. Okay? So men, you would think men run the kingdom, rule the kingdom of men, but Daniel, the prophecy, or what the word of the Lord to Daniel and to Nebuchadnezzar, and then ultimately the results of Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation is a conclusion about history. And what is that conclusion about history? God is in control. And in my mind, and Tony, I don't want to go too far off where you're at, but in my mind, that's really the major overarching theme of Daniel, isn't it? That you see it over and over and over, is God is in control. God is in control. God is in His throne. God is in His throne. And although times are tough, and although the promises seem dead, the one who promised is still in control. So what conclusions would we make about history as we look back over about 6,000 years of recorded history? What conclusions do we make? Go ahead. Okay, very, very good. As it is the acts of God, and ultimately it's for the salvation of His people. But God is the God of history. History, and this is one of the enigmas for us as people, is we don't always understand it. Sometimes we understand things better as we look back with 20/20 hindsight, but we don't always understand it. And in fact, believers of all ages have all stood in our stead and looked at history and looked backwards and understood some things by the revelation of God. They've read the historians, then they go to the Bible to see what it means, and they understand going backwards. And the promise of that history is that those promises continue in the future just like they have in the past. But with that, go to Galatians chapter 3, or Galatians chapter 4. Somebody read for us Galatians 4:4. Hey, you can go on to 5.
Got it. To redeem those under law, that we might receive the full righteousness.
Now, I don't want to spend a whole lot, but it's interesting how Paul, and he probably is not, this verse is not about history necessarily, but he says, when the fullness of time had come. What do you think he means by that? When the fullness of time had come. What's he referring to there? Okay, God's appointed time. Now, it's hard to be an open theist with a verse like this, isn't it? An open theist says God is reacting, God is responding, God doesn't know the future, God just sees a opportune moment to intervene in history and makes that intervention, not knowing exactly how it would work. Do you think Paul is an open theist here? Or do you think Paul sees this as more of just at the right time? Just at the right time, the Son of Man comes onto the scene. Just at the right time. And so the thought process in my mind as I read that is that the stage had been set. All of the players were in place. All of the lines were there. Everything was ready to go. And the Son of Man appears on stage right where He was choreographed to be, right where He was scripted to be, right at the right time of history to do His work. The God of history, the interesting thing is if you go back, this verse is really pre-shadowed by Daniel and by all of the prophets, right? Is that this Son of Man was destined to come. He was coming at just the right moment, at just the right spot in history. Now, a couple of reasons that some of you are bored with history, okay? Some folks, history was not their favorite class. And some, history is great. You love, when you know there's a historical lesson, you love it. There's others who don't necessarily like it, okay? For a Christian, history is very, very important. We are a historical faith. The historical events of our religion are very, very important to us. And so it's very, very important that when Paul says, at just the right time, with just the fullness of time, He came. He was born of a woman. He was visible. It was physical. It was a historical event that happened in human history and is verified by writers. It was a historical event. And Paul says, in 1 Corinthians 15. It's that historical event of the Son's coming and his resurrection on which we build our foundational hopes. So history is important to us. The historical events are important to us, because if the historical events are not true, then we have no hope. So history is always going to be important for Christians. Now, it's a matter of degree, obviously. There are some who are going to go much deeper and some that are not going to go quite as deep. But the historical events of the gospel are very important to us. And the historicity of the entire Bible is very, very important to us. So history will always be an important context for us, because it's the canvas on which God has painted the history of redemption. And when we look at that history of redemption from Adam's fall all the way to the blue crystal sea, when we look at that, we look at it on a canvas that is filled with events of human history, with kingdoms of men that rise and fall, and kingdoms of men that get larger and larger and larger and more powerful, to the point that kingdoms of men have bombs that can destroy the earth. Those kingdoms of men rise and they fall. They rise. Between the Testaments. You know that, and if could you pull the maps up, please? We know that the political situation is that Nebuchadnezzar first gets control of his father's empire in about 625, 630 BC, somewhere in there. He comes down from Babylon, and he's coming across toward where it says Memphis on the bottom, and he is fighting the Egyptians. Babylon has already taken over the Assyrians. And remember, in human civilization, what happens is this urbanization begins to build. Cities begin to get strong. You have cities in the north, which is really Babylon, Ashur, Ekbatana, Susa. Over to the right, you've got down on the in Egypt, you've got Memphis, and civilization seems to congregate around those cities very early on in ancient history. The cities get strong. The rulers become good administrators. There's division of labor. And pretty soon, to keep things flowing, they need resources. So they begin to grow. They begin to conquer. And as they conquer slaves, and they conquer the farmlands and the stuffs that they need for their city. And they bring those things into the city. And the city begins to grow, and it needs more resources. And so the empires begin to grow. And the empire is able to grow is only in relation, just like any business, it's in its degree of how it grows in administration, how it's able to organize, how it's able to transport goods across its bound around its empire, and how it's able to communicate. So Babylon grows. And would you go to the next slide? And so before Babylon, you see Assyria. I'm sorry, I got a little ahead of myself. So you can see the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire out of Ashur, really coming out of Turkey and Iraq, where the Kurds are now. You can see that Assyrian Empire that comes down and really goes all the way to Egypt. And that's a recurring theme. The north from Assyria going to Egypt. Well, what's between Assyria and Egypt? Palestine. Okay, Palestine. Go to the next slide. The Neo-Babylonian Empire, that's the term given for Nebuchadnezzar and his father's empire, and a couple of the sons of Nebuchadnezzar. The Neo-Babylonian Empire, you can see it doesn't quite get as far into Egypt. Egypt is getting stronger. Babylon really gets stopped around the Suez, where the Suez Canal is today. And so the Neo-Babylonian Empire, this is the empire where Jerusalem is sacked. First, they come in 605. They take away Daniel. They take away the treasures from the temple. there's some a little bit of destruction, but they become a servile nation. But the people of Jerusalem are right between Egypt and Assyria, or in Babylonia, and so they keep going back, they keep vacillating back and forth politically. Okay? So it's whoever's strongest in Palestine at the time, and so what happens that at some point, Nebuchadnezzar needs to destroy Jerusalem and pound it out of them. He can no longer let them be a ruling city because of the fact that they are not loyal. So, the next slide. The Persian Empire, the 6th, remember, 586, ultimately Jerusalem is destroyed, the walls are torn down, the temple is destroyed, and in 586, soon after that, I think it's around 540, 530, somewhere in there, the Persian Empire is under Cyrus. The Medes and the Persians take over, and they're coming from further west in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're mighty. They use a lot of horses. They're very, very swift. And this Persian Empire is going to last all the way until Alexander. It's going to last a couple of hundred years. But you can see the Persian Empire. And it's under this Persian Empire that we see the children of Israel, the children of Judah, taken into captivity and living in settlements about 1,500 miles away in near Babylon. Okay, so that's where the story, where we're at in the story is that the exile has taken place, and the children of Israel are part of Babylon and then part of the Persian Empire. Well, when Cyrus takes over, Cyrus issues a decree, and that decree allows in 538 allows the exiles under Zerubbabel to return. About 50,000 return with him. It takes them 4 months. They travel back under Zerubbabel. Now, Zerubbabel is a prince. He's in the kingly line of David. He gets back, and you remember all of the issues that they have. Finally, the temple is completed, the second temple. Remember, Solomon's temple was the first temple. It was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. In 516, the second temple, which is only a shadow of the first, was built and dedicated in 516. Then, according to your notes, Ezra returns with about 2,000 in 458, and then Nehemiah returns to be governor, and there's two times where he's governor, 444 and I think like 432, where Nehemiah returns, and remember, his claim to fame is building the walls. The temple was dedicated, but the walls were not up to protect the city, and the Samaritans who were nearby continued to assault Jerusalem and continued to persecute those that were in Jerusalem, and the two competing temples were at war. So you see, Babylon, 605 to 332, you have Babylon and the Medo-Persian Empire. Okay, during that time, Nebuchadnezzar does not, really no religious persecution at this time. Religious persecution is not really going to start until Antiochus Epiphanes, and we've heard about him. The first really religious persecution. The Persians and the Babylonians were very tolerant. In fact, the Persians believed in the god Ahura Mazda. And Ahura Mazda, they have a dualistic view of basically the world has two major powers, a dark night and a white night. And they're in continual fighting. There's continual struggle between them. And as they conquered, they saw themselves as conquering the world for Ahura Mazda. And as they went into different cultures, they saw the god, a god that looked just like Ahura Mazda. And every place they went, they saw another god that looked just like Ahura Mazda. So what they began to do is they said, this must be a god who is in Ahura Mazda's realm, in his sphere, in his kingdom. And so they tolerated them. And they said, good, add that god. Add that god. We'll take all of the gods we can because this is a mighty cosmic war. And so that's the Medo-Persians, very, very tolerant. So they are tolerant of the Jews, and in fact, they allow the Jews to actually grow and to become vibrant and to become learned and to become wealthy and to thrive in the Babylonian Empire. In fact, there are hundreds of thousands of Jews in Babylon, 50,000 return. Many stay in Babylon, which is really the beginning of what we're going to call the dispersion. So they begin to grow, but remember, they're separated from the temple, and they're separated from the sacrifices. So what they begin to do is they want to maintain their Judaism. And in fact, if you read Jewish historians say that modern Judaism is born in Babylon. Modern Judaism is born in Babylon. As they become more focused on Torah, they become more focused on the writings that develop from Torah, because the Torah for them is not sufficient to guide their culture and their society, so they begin to add to it. And circumcision becomes very important because it's what physically makes them separate from the Babylonians. The festivals become very, very important, but the festivals that have always been connected to the temple now are modified to be done to maintain the culture and to continue the culture without the temple. And so synagogues develop where they're studying the Torah and where festivals are and where Jewish cultural emblems are housed and celebrated. And so this Judaism begins to grow in Babylon. Cyrus decrees and allows the exiles to return in 538, 458, and 444. Next slide. But we know that kingdom is not to last forever. And in fact, Xerxes at some point gets all the way over. This is the next one. He gets all the way over to Greece. Gets beat at the Battle of Salamis and the Battle of Marathon. And then over a period of 100 years, slowly the Greeks gain strength. And with Philip of Macedon unifies Greece, which was a bunch of city-states, unifies them together. His son, Philip, who is educated by Aristotle, as a young man, begins a trek across the world. And you can see the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid kingdom. That's basically Alexander's empire. He's lightning fast. In fact, Napoleon and Hitler and Patton, those guys really patterned themselves after what Alexander did at the very beginning. Is he uses all of the roads and all of the communication and all of the things that the Persians used to rule their empire, he used that as a way to flash, and within a matter of years, he was all the way to India, all the way across Afghanistan to the Indus River. But he dies. Historically, I've always heard that he died of cirrhosis of the liver. You know, you see modern historians right now will say he died mysteriously of some sort of ailment. But if you go back and look at most of the historians written before the 21st century, they say he died of cirrhosis of the liver. And he died. He left his kingdom. His dying words were, I think there's going to be a great contest at my games. Because when emperors would die, there'd be great games afterwards. And he thought there was going to be great contest. And he was talking also about he didn't leave a successor. He left an unborn child who was murdered as soon as it was born. And so there was no one to take over for Alexander. Alexander, four generals take over, but of those four generals, really only two kingdoms remain, and that's the Seleucid kingdom and the Ptolemaic kingdom. Palestine is under the rule of the Ptolemies early on. The Ptolemies leave Israel alone, leave Judah alone, let them grow, are tolerant of their religion. In that time, many Jews begin to migrate down into Egypt. The great city of Alexandria, just to give you a feel, the great city of Alexandria has five boroughs. Two of them are Jewish. Alexandria becomes a strong Jewish stronghold. I shouldn't say that. There's a strong Jewish element in Egypt. There's a strong Jewish element in Babylon. When Alexander conquers, Alexander not only conquers, but he begins to settle. He begins to put little Greek cities, little Greek towns, all the way across the empire. These Greek towns begin to spread Greek culture. And for Alexander, Greek culture was the Greek language primarily, Greek literature, Greek beliefs, and Greek just Greek thought. And so he is a missionary for Greek Hellenization. That word Hellenization, if you remember, comes up in our study in the book of Acts. That's the result, ultimately, of what goes on at this period of time. So as Alexander goes west, or goes east, he brings with him Greek culture. And in fact, cities begin to be built differently. They become very organized, very square with rectangular blocks, with large agoras. Cities are ruled differently. Money changes hand and is organized differently. Commerce takes place differently. As the Greeks go across the empire, they bring with them a much more ordered civilization. They bring with them, those of you that have studied Greek history, they bring with them that concept of polis, of city, of organization. In the cities, that urbanization continues to grow, and with urbanization comes Hellenization. So the Ptolemies rule from, after Alexander dies, from 330 to 198. In 198, the Seleucids in the north, who have been fighting against the Ptolemies the entire time, the Seleucids gain control of Palestine, and things begin to change. Antiochus III, who is Antiochus the Great, conquers the Ptolemies and takes over Palestine. His son, Antiochus IV, begins, as he consolidates his kingdom, begins to see that this Jewish religion is divisive. It creates instability, and he's concerned about them and the ties with the Ptolemies. And so he begins this, what was subtle Hellenization. You can become Greeks very subtly. He becomes very, very energized, and it becomes very, very strong. And instead of evolution, it's revolution. And so he basically outlaws the Jewish faith. He outlaws Sabbath observance, forces the people to eat pork, sacks the temple, desecrates the temple, and actually makes it into a pagan temple. He basically takes away the emblem of Judaism in Jerusalem and desecrates it. He also, the high priest Onias, who is still in the Aaronic line, the Zadokite line, his brother is a Hellenist. And I got to stop here, because there's really, the way the Jews react to this Hellenization is two ways. There are those who are accommodators, and there are those who are resistors. Okay, those who accommodate are the ones who begin to Hellenize at a stronger rate. They begin to go to the gymnasium. They begin to actually reverse their circumcisions. They do surgical things to reverse their circumcision so that when their children are in the gymnasium doing athletic contests in the nude, they will not appear to be Jews. You won't know the difference between them, because their circumcision, which was a badge of honor, is actually a badge of shame in this situation. So there are accommodators and there are resistors. The resistors, some of them, one name you'll see in reading is the Hasidim. So the resistors begin to get stronger and stronger and stronger. And in fact, under one guy named Mattathias, he stands up to Antiochus and begins an armed resistance. That armed resistance, within a year, forces Antiochus to rescind his order on outlawing the Jewish religion. Mattathias has five sons. When he dies, his son Judas takes over. Judas becomes known as Judas the Hammer. The word hammer is Maccabee. So Judas Maccabeus begins to rule, and in very, very strong resistance, they eventually take over the temple and force the Greeks completely out of Jerusalem. And by, I think, 142, the Jews are an independent nation. And the Jews are independent from 142 to 63. And this is the only time in Jewish history, from 586 all the way to 1948, that you have an independent Jewish state, is during this period of time of the Maccabees. It's also called the Hasmoneans. Mattathias is from the family of Hasmon. His sons, all the way down to his last son, Simon, rule, and they basically rule Judea all the way down, that family line, all the way down until two brothers can't get along, and they're fighting over control, and both of them appeal to the Romans. And the Roman general Pompey comes in, favors one over the other, and essentially takes over Palestine in 63 AD. The Jews are smart, and when Julius Caesar is killed, Herod backs Mark Antony instead of Brutus and Cassius. Mark Antony wins, and Herod becomes a strong player in the Roman Empire, and he is given the procuratorship of Judea. There are, I think I said on the at the bottom of it that there are four, Galilee, Idumea, and Perea. They're all ruled by Antipater and his son Herod the Great. So a couple of things I want to just bring your mind to in the last 5 minutes. So from basically 586, you have the exile, 586 all the way to around 538. From 538 down to 332, you've got still Babylon and Medo-Persia. Then you've got Greece. That's really from 332 all the way down to 167 till the time of the Maccabees. So you've got the Persians, you've got the Greeks, and then you've got the Maccabees, and then you've got the Romans. And that really explains about 500 years of Jewish history. In fact, if you go back to Assyria, it almost is a millennium, right? It almost goes back to 700, 800 B.C. So a couple of things I want to talk about that change in the Jewish culture. It's very interesting is once the high priesthood stops being the Aaron line, the Zedekite line, it stops under Antiochus. Because what Antiochus does is he favors Jason, who is Onias' brother. Jason changes his name to be a Greek god's name. He favors Jason. At some point, a guy named Menelaus says, hey, if we can change high priests so easily, then how much is it worth? And so a guy named Menelaus offers a huge amount of money to become the high priest. And so he is made the high priest. And so now you have a high priest who is an appointed Seleucid ruler, not a religious leader. And from that point on, the high priesthood is never back in the correct line. It's never a correct priesthood. Okay, the control of the temple, which is the priest, is a political position that is purchased starting in about 167 B.C. When the Maccabees take over, you would think they would restore the priesthood, but they do not. What happens with the Maccabees is they become the priest, the high priest. They rule themselves. And so they, throughout the rest of the Maccabee history, they are both rulers, but they are high priests. The high priest and the political ruler and the secular ruler are the same person. Okay? So you're thinking about that, the high priest. And for us, looking back from our lens of looking through the New Testament, you know, no man makes himself a priest, right? No man takes upon himself the role of high priest. Somebody has to do that for him, right? The argument of the book of Hebrews. Well, in this historical time, what's happening? It's going to the highest bidder. Okay? The line of David really seems to stop at Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel comes as the prince. He's the grandson of Jehoiakim. He comes in, and we really don't know exactly what happens to Zerubbabel, but we know that the political line of David seems to stop at Zerubbabel. Now, many saw Zerubbabel as the Messiah. He was coming back to restore the throne of David. All of the political, everything that went along with restoring the kingdom of David and this restoring the Jewish kingdom was pinned upon Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel comes back, and Zerubbabel's clearly not the Messiah, right? He's not the Messiah. He fades away into history. We don't really know if he's a good guy or a bad guy. We really don't know what happens to him. We don't know if he tries to set up the kingdom and the Medo-Persians look at him and say, we can't trust him and take him out. We don't know if he goes back to Babylon. We're really not sure what happens to him. But the Davidic line stops. The high priests begin to rule. The high priests, the religious leaders, become the ruling force in Jerusalem. That ruling force becomes given to the highest bidder or the political leaders. Really, through all of the history, all the way to the time of Jesus, the high priest is appointed by the Gentiles. You think about that. So starting with Antiochus, essentially the high priest in Israel, ruling the temple, the focal point of all of the emblems of Judaism, is appointed by a secular Gentile dog And so that's, so it's interesting that when Jesus comes into the temple, he's coming into a temple that is not his father's house. It's whose? It's the Roman Caesar's house, right? Because the Roman Caesar essentially, although is tolerating all of the rules of the Jews, essentially, the Roman Caesar rules what happens in that temple. So changes in Jewish culture. The first thing is dispersion. Could you go to the next? The Roman Empire. What happens is that through this period of time, through this time between the Testaments, the Jews begin to disperse. They first stay in Babylon. They go to Babylon. They stay in Babylon. There are some that, in the Ptolemaic times, go down to the south, and they're in Alexandria. In fact, those of you that study the Septuagint would know that that comes out of that group of folks in the libraries of Alexandria. Then as the ascendancy of the Greeks come, the Jews begin to move toward Turkey and in toward Greece, and they follow commerce. They follow intellectuals. They follow the academics, where culture is to be found, where learning is to be found. That's where they go. And so you begin to see the Jews really populating the entire world. It's called the dispersion, is they are dispersed. And in fact, when the exiles leave in 586, never again in history will the majority of the Jews in the world be in Judea or in Palestine. There's always more Jews for the rest of human history, in part, I believe. There's always going to be more Jews throughout the world than there are actually in Judea. So what it means to be a Jew follows them, and it's not the temple and it's not the sacrifices. It's the Judaism of the synagogues. It's the Judaism of the synagogues. Jews become Hellenized. They become more Greek. It's strong with the language. And in fact, interestingly enough, in Judea, you know, Jesus probably spoke Aramaic. We believe he also spoke Hebrew because he could read from the scrolls in Hebrew. But he also converses with the Syrophoenician woman and with Pilate, who undoubtedly spoke in Greek. And so you've got, within Palestine, you've really got several different languages, but Greek, and in fact Koine Greek, becomes the language that permeates and what kind of pulls together the empire. It's the language of commerce. It's the language of the merchant. So Hellenization, Romanization, the dispersion, we've talked about the prophets, the priesthood, the temples, and the synagogues. And then finally, collaborators and resistors. That whole idea of collaboration continues. Those who are appointed to be high priest and who rule in the stead of the high priest are those who champion Hellenization, they champion Romanization, and they're primarily in the New Testament what I believe is the Sadducees. Is they're the collaborators, they're the political leaders, they're appointed by the Romans. Their wealth and their stature in society in some respects is dependent upon how well they get along with the Romans. And so they are always appeasing. They're always trying to make things okay. The resistors really split off into a couple of different realms. You've got the Pharisees, who tend to be like the Hasidim. They're the religious resistors. They're the ones that say, we are going to stay close to our Torah and to our law, and we are going to be very, very strict. And they create the subculture with many, many laws to keep themselves separate and to keep themselves pure and to keep themselves unadulterated with the Romans. And they're fighting against that Hellenization as much as they possibly can. Then you have the Zealots, which say, okay, Pharisees, you haven't taken it far enough, because as long as there's a Gentile emblem anywhere in Israel, we are a pagan nation, and we need to rise up like Elijah and Elisha. And we need to rise up against these Gentile barbarians, and we need to put them out. And the Zealots were continually fomenting rebellion. And they were saying, let's be like the Maccabees. If Matthias and his five sons could do it, we can do it also. And so they begin to stir up this nationalism. And then you have the Essenes, which the Essenes seem to be those who completely separate from society, go out in the desert like John the Baptist, like those at Qumran. And they say, we are going to be pure, and we are going to resist this Hellenization and this Romanization, and we're going to do it by getting away, by actually getting away from society. So really, that's what happens. There's a change in Judaism. There's a change in culture. In fact, the Roman Empire becomes more urban. It becomes more connected. Communication, transportation, mercantilism, all of those things that go along with trading of goods become stronger. The pathways become strong. In fact, Rome, the only way that Rome is able to continue to keep its slaves happy is because they get regular grain ships from Egypt that come up and they feed the people of Rome for free. And that was one of the benefits of living in Rome, is that you got free grain. And as long as that free grain continued, then the Caesar had no issues with the populace. But that was all dependent on keeping that organization, keeping that navy, keeping pirates out of the Mediterranean, keeping those fields in Egypt, giving that grain free as tribute to the Roman Caesar. So the last thing is the Pax Romana. As you'll hear a little bit, that's the Roman peace. Is the Romans bring peace to the empire. They bring their garrisons of their legions are all throughout the Roman Empire, and they maintain the peace. They maintain the roads. They maintain transportation. They maintain commerce. People are allowed to travel. The cities continue to grow. Those and the Greek language continues to bring people together. The official language of Rome is Latin, but what you really hear them speaking as they move out into the empire is Greek. So any questions? Again, we covered about 6 weeks of material in one time. Any questions, concerns, clarifications? And if you remember our study, and I didn't say a lot about that just because I thought our study in the Gospel of Acts, or not the Gospel of Acts, but the Acts of the Apostles, I thought really highlighted the fact that all of this structure of the Roman Empire, this big spider web, is the Gospel permeates through all of those lines of communication. Wherever there's lines of communication that were set up for the trading of goods, those lines become pathways of the Gospel. And ultimately, where does the Gospel go? One of our favorite books in the Bible is the Gospel and the Epistle to what? The Romans. The Gospel eventually gets to Rome, and in fact, we learn from the book of Philippians, it gets all the way into Caesar's household, right? All the way into Caesar's household. So how do the events in Palestine get all the way into within 30 years, get all the way into the household of Caesar? They do so because of this network of what God had set. When the fullness of time came, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, right? And this is the fullness of time. It was just the right time, in just the right situation. So, a lot of interesting things to talk about. I'd love to talk to you about Hanukkah, but we'll save that for another time. Thanks.